Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton. I'm Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome all of you here for the fourth in this four-part series of lectures by Professor John Rigdon about Albert Einstein's papers in 1905. It's very nice to see so many of you back. I've noticed that quite a few have been attending all of the lectures, and that's certainly a tribute to both Professor Rigdon and your interest and the overpowering importance of Albert Einstein 100 years later to compete with such a beautiful fall weekend. John Rigdon is an honorary professor of physics at Washington University in St. Louis and is co-editor of the journal Physics in Perspective. He received his Bachelor of Science from Eastern Nazarene College and his PhD from Johns Hopkins University, whereafter he did a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard University, and has served on the faculties of Eastern Nazarene College, Middlebury College, and the University of Missouri-St. Louis. In 1987, he joined the American Institute of Physics, where he served as director of physics programs. His scholarly research has been in the areas of molecular physics and the history of science. Professor Rigdon's professional activities have been at the national and international levels. He was editor of the American Journal of Physics from 1975 to 1985. In 1992, he was the Director of Development of the National Science Standards Project at the National Academy of Sciences. In 1995, he was elected Chairman of the History of Physics Forum of the American Physical Society. He has served on numerous committees of the American Association of Physics Teachers, the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the National Academy of Sciences. He was NSF consultant to India in 1968 and 69, and was the United States representative to the International Science Exhibition in Rangoon, Burma in 1970, a Fulbright Fellow to Burma in 71, and to Uruguay in 1975. In celebration of the 100th anniversary of Einstein's monumental achievements, which is, of course, why we're all here, John recently came out with Einstein 1905, The Standard of Greatness, which, for those of you who don't know, is on sale outside of the building, just outside of the atrium. And we urge you to pick up a copy as you leave, because you will find a very thought-out, comprehensive analysis, much like what you have been witnessing over this past weekend. They're sold out. Well, go to Amazon then and get some. A good sign, sold out. In addition to this book, John is also the author of Physics and the Sound of Music, Rabbi, Scientist, and Citizen, and Hydrogen, the Essential Element. Professor Rigdon is a fellow of the American Association of the Advancement of Science and the American Physical Society. He holds an honorary doctorate of science degree from Denison University and was recently awarded the prestigious Millikan Award by the American Association of Physics Teachers. Ladies and gentlemen, for one penultimate time, because there will be a bistro banter session at 4 o'clock with myself and Stephen Kern and John, should he survive until then, please welcome Professor John Rigdon.
Well, I want to add my word to Howard Burton's. You are to be commended. I see many faces now for the second, third, fourth time. And I want to say why I think you should be commended, because you're doing the right thing, not because it's this me talking, but you have this big brain. And it's my opinion, now this is my opinion, it is my opinion that we get out of bed in the morning the most eagerly when we have facing us the opportunity to engage mentally, intellectually in some kind of activity. We engage our mind. And here you are, you know, you're going to be listening to stuff like Einstein does this and does that. So you're going to be thinking. And I, you know, when you spend time in activities that simply bring pleasure, when the activity is over, the pleasure's ended. But when you're doing something intellectually, that stays with you. And you can think about it, and you can, particularly if you're doing something that you can build and build, and so that tomorrow you know more than you did today, and you know more today than you did yesterday. Nobody can touch that. Nobody can take it away from you. And it can be an enormous source of fulfillment. So My hope is that you've learned something, that you've had your wheels stimulated to turn a bit, and mostly, I hope you'll go to the library, get a book or two, and follow up on something, learn more about it. It's wonderful. So, I commend you. One of the privileges of my life through a series of circumstances is the fact that I've gotten to know a lot of very good people. I mean, by good people, I don't mean good. Good versus bad. I mean Nobel laureates. I know lots of Nobel laureates, not because of anything of me, because, well, I wrote a biography of Robbie, who was a Nobel laureate, and all of his friends I interviewed, and I got to know a lot of his friends who were Nobel laureates, and they were very powerful, big, important people. And then I was at the American Institute of Physics for a long time, and in that position, I was sort of in a central position of the physics community and got to know a lot of people. Now, I'll tell you, not all Nobel laureates are particularly bright. Some of them are lucky. But I've met two kinds of people. No, I've met lots of kinds, but I distinguish between two kinds when it comes to physics. There's the brilliant, and there's the deep. The brilliant has a mind that works at the speed of light. The deep thinks more slowly. Robert Oppenheimer. You all know Robert Oppenheimer, atomic bomb, you know, Los Alamos. Robert Oppenheimer was brilliant. He ranged over the whole of physics, but he did not accomplish too much that was really significant. And it is a subject of discussion within physics. Why didn't Oppenheimer accomplish more? He was so bright. He was so bright that Hans Bethe, who just died, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ago, probably the last of the physicists of this era, who sort of stood astride the whole discipline, Hans Bethe almost knew everything. Let me tell you a story. After he talked at a session, a guy from Tulane came up and said, I want to shake hands with the last physicist who understands all of physics. And Hans sort of snickered and he said, Val, I only understand about 96%. And he probably was not, he may have been conservative. I mean, maybe he was 97%. But anyways, Hans Bethe said, You could say one sentence, and Oppenheimer knew where you were going and understood the whole thing and finished it for you. I mean, he knew what you were doing, and he was that quick. Well, Oppenheimer was brilliant. By contrast, Robbie, a very close friend of Oppenheimer, was deep. And Einstein was deep. A good friend of mine, Beinisch Hoffman, who's written books, The Tyranny of Testing, some of you may have read that, about vectors, sorry, an interesting book. The Strange Story of the Quantum, another Beinisch Hoffman book. Beinisch wanted to work very badly. He wanted to work so much for Einstein. And so he made application, and when he finished his PhD dissertation, his thesis advisor took him to the Institute for Advanced Study. And the interview began, and they began by sitting down, and they had tea, and they chatted. And Beinisch said to me, you know, several times, I was so scared. I was so nervous. I wanted that job. I wanted to do well. He really wanted to work for Einstein. Well, at some point, Einstein said, well, why don't you tell me what you've been doing? He said, there's a blackboard. So Beinisch got up and started talking and, you know, wrote some things on the blackboard. Scared, nervous. And after about a minute and a half, Einstein said, Stop, stop, stop. I think very slowly. I don't understand you. If I'm to understand you, you're going to have to go much more slowly. Well, you see, that's a lot of us. We need a little time. We don't think rapidly. You see, Oppenheimer would have said, hurry up, hurry up. But deep thinkers generally are a little less accelerated in the way they think about things, but they dig deeply. Eisenhower. Where did that come from? Einstein thought deeply. Well, all right, folks. We have talked about the March paper, which was the, and some of you weren't here, so I'll just recapitulate for a couple of minutes. 1905, Einstein wrote five very important papers in just a little over 6 months. The March paper, which was the first, was the only paper which Einstein himself identified and called revolutionary. And it proposed that light consists of particles. And that absolutely flew in the face of 100 years plus of knowledge about light, accepted knowledge about light. And the idea was rejected absolutely and was not given much attention for 18 years. All right, that was March. In April and May, April being his dissertation, and May, the Brownian motion, proved really for the final and convincing fashion the reality of atoms. And from that point on, all the skeptics slipped into their holes and no longer expressed negative thoughts about the reality of atoms. So Einstein had that, and in addition, he did other things. Now, I have started with this slide. I introduced this slide the first time, and all I want to say with this slide is that when Einstein started working in the early part of the 20th century, and the big year was 1905, there were carryover problems from the 19th century, and these big theories, there are five big theories of physics, five big theories, great theories. Mechanics, Newton, mechanics. Electromagnetism, a number of names, but Maxwell probably the most important. Thermodynamics, a number of names, but Carnot and Lord Kelvin and other names. Quantum mechanics, Heisenberg, Schrodinger, Dirac, Bohr. And relativity, Einstein. These are the five great theories of physics. And these great theories need to be compatible with each other. You can't have great theory number two contradicting great theory number three, or there's problems. And there were problems in 1900. And the problems were between these dishes, which I've talked about, and I only, this afternoon, it's the bottom two dishes. And the reason they're dishes, for those of you who think, what the hell is he talking about, dishes? Is I likened it to, you know, blending. And when you make gravy, often you put flour in the meat juice to thicken it a bit, and the objective is to have a nice, smooth, thickened stock that you put on potatoes, and it's wonderful. But occasionally the flour does bad things, and it gets lumpy, and you say, oh God, it's awful. Well, these were lumpy dishes. They didn't blend. The words up there after these dishes, for example, look at number two up there, thermodynamics and kinetic theory. They were both very important, but they didn't blend. Einstein had a hand, in fact, he had the hand, in making all of these dishes come together in a very wonderful fashion, so that after 1905, these dishes were edible by everyone, you know? All right, now, We're going to not talk about all these issues, but today we're going to talk, or this afternoon, we're going to talk about these bottom two, light in the ether, mechanics, and electromagnetism. Now, this leads to the June paper, paper number 4 out of the 5. The June paper was the theory of relativity. That paper sparked controversy. Not because they thought it was necessarily wrong, but because the conclusions that came out of that were so contrary to common sense that people couldn't believe it. They didn't want to believe it, and they rejected it. And that is still true. Howard said that I was editor of American Journal of Physics for 10 years, 75 to 85. I will say that during that time, I received probably 7, 8, 9 manuscripts a year. And the attempt of the author was to show how Einstein was wrong. Einstein is a big target, a big, big target. Any physicist that comes along and is able to show that Einstein was wrong is going to get front page room on the New York Times and whatever your paper is. I mean, I know you have papers. But I don't know what the equivalent of the New York Times is in Canada. So whatever that is, the London Times, or the Toronto Times. But if somebody proves Einstein wrong, it will be big news, and the person will become instantly well known. So Einstein has been in the target, in the crosshairs of a lot of people as they try to show him wrong. And let me just say, with 2005 approaching, the theory of relativity, the June paper, has been squeezed about as hard as you can squeeze it, trying to find if there isn't some way in which it doesn't quite stack up, where it breaks down just a little bit. And so far, a lot of effort, they haven't been able to touch it, and it stands solid. So Mr. Einstein is doing well, thank you very much, as of today. So, all right, now, Einstein's relativity paper, all of his papers have a quality and a style that I find quite charming. But his relativity paper probably stands out from the rest. I just want to read you two things. Abraham Pice he died recently, was a biographer of Einstein. The name of the biography is Subtle as the Lord. Professional biography. Is that what you call it? I mean, it doesn't talk much about his children and his family, and you know, it's what he did. So what is that, a professional biography, I guess? Anyways, but if you want to know what Einstein did, there's a lot of mathematics in it, but you can page through it and pick up things here and there. It's a very good biography. So Pice has written that Einstein's June paper ranks, quote, among the highest achievements in science, in content, as well as in style. You don't hear that often. Scientific papers are lousy reading. Here's another quote, this one from Arthur Miller, who has done a lot of work on Einstein. Arthur Miller is in London. Page for page, Einstein's relativity paper is unparalleled in the history of science in its depth, breadth, and sheer intellectual virtuosity. Einstein developed one of the most far-reaching theories in physics in a literary and scientific style that is parsimonious, yet not lacking in essentials, in a pace that, where necessary, possessed a properly slow cadence, yet was presented in 30 pages of print, is developed almost like an essay. Written in white heat in about 5 weeks, It is pristine in form, and yet, in its own way, as complete as Newton's book length Principia. Now, everybody agrees in physics, everybody, that the Principia is the greatest book ever written in physics. Einstein didn't write a book in June. He wrote a paper, 32-page paper. Is that what Arthur said? I forget. I just read it, folks. 30 pages. So in that paper, though, that paper is routinely held up for its style and for the way he develops things. So all right, if you have a chance, you ought to look at that. So all right, here was now Mr. Einstein standing at this table with all these dishes, and the two that we're concerned with now is light in the ether and mechanics and electromagnetism. In order to appreciate these issues and to appreciate the content of the June paper, we need to do just a little bit of groundwork. If I ask you, where is Winnipeg? What do you say? Anybody? Yes.
In Manitoba.
Yes, in Manitoba. That's right. But I want something different than that. Where is Winnipeg? You're right. West of here. All right. How far? Roughly. 1,000 kilometers? What? 1,000, whatever. I didn't hear you, but that's all right. Look, when I say where is Winnipeg, you're making an assumption when you answer. And the assumption is that I mean relative to Waterloo. Where is Winnipeg? You wouldn't say 2,000 kilometers east, pretending that I mean Vancouver. You wouldn't do that. So when you answer the question, you make an assumption about something very important, which is what I want to talk about for a couple minutes. And that is, you assume what I'll call a frame of reference, or you assume a coordinate system. What is a coordinate system? What is a frame of reference? Well, you all know what it is, because you've all probably read and you've done things. You know, every pirate map, where there's a treasure buried, it always has an origin, an oak tree. Go to the old oak tree, walk 12 paces north, walk 6 paces east, and start digging. Now, you see, if I said walk 12 paces north and 6 paces east, you wouldn't know what to do unless you were told from the oak tree. The oak tree, that's the origin, that's the start. And you know, you've seen pirate maps, and there's always something like the oak tree, and then so many paces, and so forth. So that's a frame of reference. The oak tree is the origin of a coordinate system or a frame of reference. We use those terms interchangeably. I prefer frame of reference. I probably use that. Now, so to find the position of the buried treasure, you need a coordinate system. You need a frame of reference. The same thing is true with regard to speed. If I say 60 kilometers an hour, if I say 60 kilometers an hour, well, you don't know what that means. If I say I'm moving in my car at 60 kilometers an hour, then you make an assumption, which is a valid assumption. Oh, you mean with respect to highway whatever. So you're passing over the road at such a speed that in 1 hour, you will be 60 kilometers down the road. All right? But it's always with respect to the highway. Now, when you look at something like this, you know, here's my 78 kilometers an hour passing down the highway, and the speed is relative to the highway. But suppose I'm on a barge, or raft, I say. Suppose I'm on a raft, big raft, and we're floating down the Mississippi, and the Mississippi Current is 5 kilometers per hour, and I'm walking on the raft at 4 kilometers per hour. Now, if I say I'm moving 4 kilometers per hour, that doesn't jive with somebody standing along the shoreline of the Mississippi. Because what the observer along the Mississippi sees is he sees me walking at 4 kilometers per hour at the same time the raft is being carried downstream at 5 kilometers per hour. So I am passing the shrubbery along the riverbank at a total rate of 9 kilometers per hour. You understand? You know that, right? I mean, you absolutely know that. I hope there's no one that wonders why that's true. Okay. But you see, the point is, I could be accurate and say I am moving at 4 kilometers per hour. I could also be accurate by saying I'm moving at 9 kilometers per hour. It just depends on what reference frame I am thinking about. Okay? Now, these are important terms for what is to follow. All right. Now, to make it just a little bit, here is a reference frame. Notice it's just a simple XYZ coordinate system. Oh, look, no. I've added the word inertial. That's an important term. An inertial reference frame is a reference frame that is at rest, and we will assume what we mean by that is at rest relative to the Earth. Okay, so here is a way, this coordinate system, within this XY, you can see it, right? Within this XYZ system, I can locate any point. I can give you coordinates for points from here to New York City. Put this origin on this stage in the Perimeter Institute, and from that origin, I can locate anything you want. So many kilometers northeast, so many, you know, and so on and so forth. All right? So here's a good reference frame. And it's inertial because it is at rest. Now here's the same thing in 2 dimensions. It's just easier to draw rather than 3. But here's a reference frame moving at a constant velocity v. This is also an inertial reference frame. So any reference frame that is moving with a constant velocity or is stationary at rest, they are both inertial reference frames. Now, what I want to say is that these two reference frames are identical. Oh, poop. Somehow it went out. Do you want Jacob to come down here and find out what went on? Anyways, the one at rest and the one at constant velocity, are identical. You know, that is just amazing. When you are flying over Vancouver, or no, over Winnipeg, at 30,000 feet, and you're moving at 500 miles an hour, your coffee cup sits on the tray in front of you, and you cannot tell the difference between that coffee cup and the coffee cup of the Winnipeg farmer sitting down on her front porch with a coffee cup in front of her. This coffee cup is stationary with respect to the Earth. This coffee cup is moving at 500 kilometers an hour, 800 kilometers an hour. You cannot tell the difference between those two coffee cups. Now, there is no way, there is no way within that plane that you can determine that you are moving. I hit that with paper. I don't know what happened. Look, I hate that thing anyways. You can't get it? Okay. Anyways, you can't tell the difference. Now, if your airplane hits turbulent air and it begins to bounce around, then your coffee jiggles around and you say, oh, I'm moving, you know. Then you know that. But you're no longer in an inertial reference frame because you're no longer moving at a constant velocity. You're jiggling around and then, you know, you're doing things. So these two terms need to be looked at. Thank you, Jacob. Jacob's a good man. Here's where we were. These are identical. Okay? So, okay. Well, all right. That's kind of background. Now, the first dish is called, or was called, whatever I called it. What did I call it? Ether and light. Light and ether? Light and ether. There it is. The first dish is this. When it was determined that light was an electromagnetic wave, the question immediately, there were two problems. Coming out of electromagnet, there were two problems. The first problem was, what is the medium, what is the stuff that through which that light wave moves? Because waves require a medium. You can't have water waves without water. You can't have sound waves without air. If this was a vacuum in this room, you would see... Goddamn thing. You think, what's the matter with him anyway? You wouldn't hear a thing. So a medium is required. And light was considered a wave, and so a medium was required. What was the medium? You see, it's a problem because light gets to Earth from all over the universe. Every star out there from far away and from the east and the west and all over southern hemisphere, northern, you know, it's, light is getting to the Earth. So whatever the medium is, it has to be everywhere. So they invented this ether, this stuff, very unusual stuff, through which light propagated, through which light carried the light from star to Earth. Now just think a minute. At the same time, the Earth is orbiting the Sun, so the Earth is going through this ether. And the ether is not, apparently, dragging down the Earth's speed, in which case the Earth would slowly lose speed and spiral into the Sun over some period of time. So this ether is very unusual stuff. But the ether was the medium through which light propagated. And the other problem was this. Coming out of electromagnetism, when they discovered, or when the mathematics showed that there were electromagnetic waves, they also showed that there was a particular speed with which these electromagnetic waves moved. And that was 300,000 kilometers per second. Now you see, I don't think you know that, do you? Do you know that speed? If I say 186,000 miles per second, you know that speed? But you see, you're Canadians. The equivalent of 186,000 miles per second, I believe, is 300 kilometers per second. No? What? I'm sorry, say it again. That's what I said. What did I say? I didn't say 300. Oh. 300,000. 300,000 kilometers per second is the speed of light. And that's what came out of the mathematics. Now, immediately, based on what we just talked about, the question arises, 300,000 with respect to what? What? Well, people thought maybe the fixed stars. They're not really fixed, but they appear to be fixed. Maybe with respect to... Well, they finally decided it was 300,000 kilometers per hour, per second, relative to the ether. So in the ether frame, which the light moved through, it was 300,000 kilometers per second. Okay. Now, immediately there was a problem. And the problem arises because when you say that, you can start imagining some experiments. Here is the Earth. And the Earth is moving through along its orbit to the right. Okay, it's moving along its orbit to the right. Now set up an experiment up there at the top of the Earth. And think of shining light out to the right and measuring the speed of the light. Now remember when I was walking on the raft and the raft was moving down the river? In this case, you see, the speed of light measured should be the sum of the light speed plus the speed of the Earth. Because the apparatus is being carried along by the Earth, and so the two of them would add together and give you a bigger number than the actual speed of the light. What you could do, though, is you could take that speed and then shine the light the other direction. Now the light is going slower because the speed of the motion of the Earth is essentially subtracting from the speed of the light. And between the two of those, you could deduce the velocity of the Earth through the ether. Wonderful. You know, you could do that. Well, this was tried. And not only tried, it was tried very well. A wonderful new apparatus that provided unexcelled precision. Tested this thing, and they found zero. They found that there was no evidence that the Earth was moving through the ether. And they thought maybe the Earth is dragging the ether along with it. So they went up on mountaintops, did the experiment on nothing. Maybe it's because it's spring. We'll do it in the fall, you know. So they did, you know, they did different things. They tried everything, but they could not find it. So this is all background, you see. So in 19, well, then there was one other problem. There was one other problem. And that comes down now to that next dish, mechanics and electromagnetism. And the problem is that mechanics, the laws of mechanics hold in all inertial reference frames. All. You can't distinguish between inertial reference frames by the laws of mechanics. The laws of mechanics are the same and good in every one. It's like the cup of coffee in your plane, the cup of coffee on the farmhouse porch. You can't tell right now, you can't tell that you're in motion. You can't tell that. But yet here you are, sitting in Perimeter Institute, on an Earth that's not only spinning around on its axis pretty quickly, but moving like hell along its orbit. But you see, the motion of the Earth is essentially inertial. So you don't feel any of the effects of the motion, and it doesn't exhibit itself in any measurable way. Very good measurements, very subtle measurements, can tell you, in fact, you are on a moving Earth. There are measurements that can do that, but the magnitude of the effects are so small that you sit there unaware that you are moving. Okay? None of you are aware. So this is what we're talking about. Inertial reference frames, you cannot distinguish between them. Now, that's mechanics. Now along comes this beautiful theory of electromagnetism, and I'll be damned, it doesn't work. It is different in different inertial reference frames. What does that mean? Are the laws of mechanics really good? And if so, where do they have their valid form? Sitting on the Earth? Flying over the Earth? What is the valid form of these laws? Well, the answer was that the laws of electromagnetism had their valid form in the framework of the ether. So the ether comes back. All right, now those are the two problems that were sitting on the table. And in 1905, June 30th, Einstein finished paper number 4 on the theory of relativity, which changed a lot of things. And I want to see, here's the very first sentence of this paper. It is well known that Maxwell's electromagnetism, when applied to moving bodies, leads to asymmetries that do not seem to attach to the phenomenon. Now, what are the asymmetries? The asymmetries are that the laws of electromagnetism seem to distinguish between reference frames, while the law, I don't know what I said. The laws of electromagnetism seem to distinguish between reference frames, while the laws of mechanics do not. That's an asymmetry. Mechanics behaves one way, electromagnetism behaves another way. And asymmetries of that sort got under Einstein's skin, and he couldn't deal with it. Now, all of relativity in June paper is written in the first page, the first paragraph. Think of that. Now, here it is. This is it, the whole thing. But I'm not going to make you read that, because this is not the way it's usually presented. It's usually presented in a much more simple way. It's presented like this, and now all I've done is break this apart into sections. And, all right, now if you read this, the red print, what you read is, not only in mechanics, but in electrodynamics as well, the phenomena do not have properties corresponding to the concept of absolute rest, but that in all coordinate systems in which the mechanical equations are valid, also the same electrodynamics and optical laws are valid. So he asserts that in all reference frames the mechanics laws are valid, so are the laws of electromagnetism. You say, well, hot dog, Albert. I mean, you know, how do you justify that? Well, then in a set, by the way, this has become the first principle. There's two principles of relativity that around which the whole theory is based, that's wrong, out of which the whole theory comes. So the first principle is the laws of physics, all physics, electrodynamics, mechanics, the laws of physics are good in all inertial reference frames. Doesn't matter where you are. All right? And then the second principle is in green. And it says the second postulate, only seemingly incompatible with the former one, that in empty space, light is always propagated with a definite velocity v, which is independent of the state of motion of the emitting body. So that if I have a flashlight and I'm shining it at you, you know, come running at you, the speed of light is not any different as you measure it going by you than if I stand still and the light comes at you. All right? In fact, when he says only seemingly incompatible, my God, it is absolutely incompatible. These two principles, red and green, that's it. That is the theory of relativity. And now all you need to do, take these home and sit and think very hard about what the consequences of these are and how are you going to remove the incompatibility, because there is an incompatibility. I'll show you what the incompatibility is. The incompatibility is right here. I don't know if you can understand. You can understand this. Look at this. I have a light source up there. You see that on the left, that sunbeam, I mean that yellow thing, that's a light, okay? Got it? That's a light. And out from that light source comes light at some velocity, the velocity of light. Now A, standing there, is standing right on the platform where the source of light is, and A measures the speed of light. In the meantime, that platform is moving to the right with some velocity, and B sees the velocity of light as the sum of the light plus the motion of that barge or whatever it is. You appreciate that? All right? Now, on the other hand, here is a guy C, an observer C, who is moving along parallel with the wagon up on top. And so he's running alongside the light. You know, when you pass a car, you're going 81 kilometers an hour, and you pass a car going 80 kilometers an hour, you look over, and you can read the newspaper in the window next door. And you're passing at a speed, relative speed of 1 kilometer per hour. You know, so the speed, the light is going to pass C going slower. So we would conclude from this that the velocity as measured by B is the greatest, the velocity measured by A is the next, and the velocity as measured by C is the least. So when Einstein says the velocity of light is a constant, You look at that and you say, come on, Mr. Albert, what have you been smoking? That's not make sense. That does not make sense at all. So, what's the problem? Well, the problem is, the problem is really fundamental. And the problem is, oh my Lord, the problem is that when we think about space and time, we are confused. I'll tell you what is at the root of the problem. The root of the problem is speed of light is a constant. That's what the principle says. If the speed of light were 1,000 kilometers per second, we would be living in an entirely different world. But the speed of light is A, very large. It is very large, 300,000 kilometers per second. That's large. But it's finite. It's not infinite. If it were infinite, light would be reaching us from everywhere instantaneously. It doesn't take any time, if the speed is infinite, to get from A to B. And because the speed of light is finite, and because it's very large, a lot of the properties that come out of the theory of relativity are masked for us, because we live in a world where customarily we walk along at a few kilometers an hour, and we ride bicycles, and we do things, and the speeds with which we conduct our lives are very, very small compared to the speed of light. If we were able to get up to the speed of light, we would see a lot of strange things that we now don't see. Well, all right, and so what Mr. Einstein does then in this paper is he proceeds to look at time and space very carefully. Let me, we're just a bit running out of time. Let me give you a couple examples. One of the consequences of relativity is that length is relative. Look at these two things. If I have a 2 meter sticks up there in the top, they are both at rest in the frame of reference at the top, and they agree exactly. They both are a meter. Now if you take the brown one, or no, I guess it's the gold one, and put the gold one in motion with a velocity v, the moving meter stick will be shorter than the brown meter stick, which you just compared to yesterday. They were exactly the same. A moving meter stick, moving length. By the way, length is space. Space is length times length times length. That's the volume of your room. That's the space of your room. Three-dimensional space is a meter this way, a meter that way, a meter this way. All right, so length is a part of space. Length is relative. People in different inertial frames have different lengths for that meter stick. All right? And in the same sense, clocks don't agree. A moving clock slows relative to a fixed clock. Now, there's some really bizarre consequences of this if you follow it out. I mean, I'm looking for an appropriate age for, well, there's, are you a mother? You are. You see, we can take this mother, put her on a rocket ship, send her off at 90% the speed of light for a few years, and when she comes back, we can send her on a trip such that when she comes back, her children will be older than she is. Okay? Her clock in motion will slow down relative to the clocks of her children. Now, what are the clocks? Well, you know, she has all kinds of clocks. She gets hungry every noon. She eats, and after a little while, she eats again. There's processes going on inside us that have clock-like behavior. So in this rocket ship, she would eat much fewer times relative to what the children are eating back on Earth, because their clocks are running faster. Hours between hers, according to kids, would be, you know, forever, years between meals. So It's a very strange effect. But let me tell you, these effects have been validated through measurements. They're not fiction. They're real. And the reason they're so bizarre to us is that the speed of light is so fast, and we typically move so slowly, that we are not conscious of any of these effects. But they're real. Now, let me just show you, for example. If you take a 1,000-centimeter steel beam and have it move at 10% the speed of light, 10%, that's 30,000 kilometers per second. That's pretty fast. Well, the length of the beam will be measured at 995 centimeters. In other words, it'll be shortened by 5 centimeters. At half the speed of light, the length will be 866 centimeters. It'll be shortened by 34 centimeters. And at 90% the speed of light, the length will be 436, and it'll be shortened by 564 centimeters. And if you go to 0.99, you could, in principle, sort of make the thing disappear, except you can't make it disappear. Why? Because you can't exceed the speed of light. You can get right up to the speed of light, but you can't exceed it, because there's something else. As objects like an orange has a certain mass, and you accelerate this orange faster and faster and faster, as you get really going fast and approaching the speed of light, at the speed of light, the mass of the orange becomes infinite. Now, you can't push an infinite thing around. You can't make an infinite thing go bigger, go faster. So there's a speed limit, and that's the speed of light. Well, these two things, these two principles, work out a number of bizarre consequences: length, time, mass. But there's one other consequence that came later, and that is, by the way, so the essence of it is, in a way, we all have our own times, but they're in such close agreement, because we move so slowly, that we don't pick up the fact that your time is different than my time. There was one more consequence that came out, and that was the consequence in September, and that was the famous E equals mc squared, and I just show you this. This was the September paper, and I am struggling to find it. This is the way he did that, and I will be done here. Oh no, I want to do one more thing. But what he did was, he said, look, suppose two light beams go out of this box. The light beam has energy E, one-half E. The other has one-half E. And they go out of this box. Now, you have two observers. The box, according to A, the box and B are moving to the right with the velocity V. Now, if that box loses energy, how can the principle of relativity be satisfied, which says all inertial reference frames are equivalent? You can't tell which one is moving. You see, A could say that the kinetic energy of the box decreases. But if the kinetic energy of the box decreases, then observer B is going to feel some effects of that, because he has to slow down. And in order to slow down, you have to put your brakes on. You feel a force. Well, he's not going to slow down, because if he slowed down, that would distinguish. Then people would be able to say, oh, the guy that felt the slowdown, he's moving. But you see, you look at your coffee cups, you can't tell who's moving. You cannot tell who's moving. You cannot tell who's moving in those two inertial reference frames. So the only other way of justifying it so that both observers are satisfied is that the kinetic energy, which is one-half mv squared, V has to stay the same. Otherwise, you'd be able to distinguish between the two frames of reference. But M changes. So when the energy leaves that box, the box loses a little bit of mass. And that energy, E equals mc squared. The amount of energy lost is E equals mc squared. And he derives it in a very three pages. Now, let me tell you something that was beautiful. I told you this morning, some of you, that Einstein never left his papers up in the air. This was 1905. Radioactivity was discovered in 1896 by Becquerel. Nobody knew about it. I mean, what was this radioactivity? All of a sudden, an atom spits out an energetic particle. By the way, we didn't know what atoms were. We didn't have a clue what atoms were. In 1905, the nucleus had not been discovered, would not be discovered until 1911. But what Einstein did was, he said, look at radium. Look at radium. Radium was discovered by Madame Curie in 1898, and it was a particularly hot radioactive source. Highly energetic particles came spumping out of uranium atoms. Nobody knew what they were. But where does that energy come from? How do these particles get that energy? Well, Einstein in 1905 was in essence predicting nuclear energy. He said, look at radium. And what they tried to do very soon after that, is they weighed samples of radium over time to see how much mass they lost as a consequence of giving these particles energy. But the difference was so small they couldn't detect it until later on. But his intuition was so on target. Look at radium. Well, look, we're really done, but I want to come back to one thing. I started out yesterday, it seems like 3 weeks ago. I started out saying that Einstein was a standard of greatness, and I raised the question why, and I sort of have played around with the answer in the first talk, but I want to come back to it. Clearly, Einstein is great because of what he did, and his greatness is rooted in that. And I would say how he did it as well. I mean, I think the whole ball goes together. But you see, people all over this world look up to Einstein. You put a face of Einstein anywhere in the world and they know who it is. What is it about Time magazine in 1999 named Albert Einstein Person of the Century? Now, when you think of all the people in the 20th century who made marks of significance on world affairs, on whatever, you know. My God, they could have named Elvis Presley. Think of all the people they could have named. But they named Einstein. They named a physicist. I don't think that's an accident. I think if Einstein had been a literary critic, he would not have been named, okay? I think if Einstein had been a chemist, he would not have been named. I think the fact that he was a physicist was very, very important, and here is why. And I've said it, I'm just going to summarize. We as Homo sapiens are special. We survive, we are the thinking animal. We survive through our wit. John Locke said, we are inundated by sensations. Right now, you are inundated by the sound waves impinging on your ear, and those sensations are making some sense to you, some kind of sense to you. But in the meantime, you're inundated by the light, and so you're a lot of, and then you walk outside, and the way you make sense of those sensations is you, through reason, you order those sensations so you know what to do and how to conduct your life. Reason is how we survive. That's what makes us different than all the other animals. Now, because Einstein was a physicist, he was able to exhibit in the most dramatic ways what it means to be the thinking animal. And physics makes that possible. When Einstein finished general relativity, he predicted, man, something unbelievable. He predicted that when light passed the sun, its path would be deviated by 1.75 arc seconds. That was a prediction. 4 years later, the experiment was done, and it was 1.61 arc seconds. Pretty close. Einstein's prediction was considered vindicated, verified. And Einstein was front page on the Toronto Times, the New York Times, the London Times, and papers all over the world. Why did that strike Homo sapiens in such a strong way? Well, the war had just ended in 1919. People were emotionally drained, and they wanted the world to make sense once again. And here was Albert Einstein, with the power of his mind, making a prediction that was so bizarre. How on earth did he, first, how did he ever get to that? I mean, you don't look out your window and say, I guess maybe life's bins as it goes in. It doesn't happen, all right? Think of the route intellectually that he took to get to the point where he could make a prediction quantitatively, 1.75 arc second. It's stunning. And he couldn't have done that as a biologist. He couldn't have done that as a novelist. He couldn't have done that as president of the United States. But he could do that as a physicist. So I believe, I'm proposing, well, I believe it, but I'm also just proposing. I mean, it may not make any sense, but I'm proposing that the reason Einstein is held in such high regard is that we as Homo sapiens share in some way Einstein's great accomplishments. He vindicates us. We're not as good as he is, but we have heads, and we have minds, and we have reason, just like he does, and we can hold him up as sort of the example. He's no Einstein, but... That's it, folks.
At this point, we have time for a few questions before John has to go to his next appointment. If you just hold
up
your
hand...
By the
way, you've had good questions, so feel good about asking a question.
So somebody will come by with the microphone when you hold up your hand. Thank you very much.
Now, ask an easy question. Come on.
Well, thank you very much for your inspiring lecture. Well, I have a question here. Is that yesterday you said that gravitation is one of the four fundamental forces in nature. So as far as I understand, Einstein modeled gravitation as a curvature of space-time continuum. So my question is, did Einstein believe that gravitation as a force in support of Newton's law? Or if not, would it be one of the reasons why gravitation cannot be unified with other three forces of nature?
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I'm not sure I quite followed your question, and it's too long to repeat. One of the public misconceptions is that science is always proving itself wrong. That's not true. That's not true. Newton will never, ever be proved wrong. What he will be proved is that Newton's ideas have limits. And up to those limits, he is money in the bank. But beyond those limits, things break down a bit. And what Einstein showed was that Newton's ideas break down. All right? He didn't deny what Newton had done. Quantum mechanics does not undercut mechanics. We went to the moon. We orbit things up there. And it's all done by Newton, except for the electronics on board, which is high-level stuff. But in terms of getting there and getting back, we didn't use Einstein, we used Newton. Newton works perfectly well, and it's straightforward and simple. Quantum mechanics tells us that when you get to the really small scale of electrons and atoms and so forth, then the laws of Newton and electromagnetism are shown to fall short. One of the big things of the 20th century is that we've pushed the extremes. You know, we lived in a little world of Roy G. Biv. You know what that means? Huh? How many know Roy G. Biv? He's a good guy. Red, orange, yellow, G. Green, Biv. Blue, indigo, violet. That's the visible spectrum. You look up at a rainbow, it goes, well, that's what our eyes see. All right? We lived in that world for centuries. Roy G. Biv. And then we got instruments that could see shorter wavelengths. And there's a whole bunch of shorter wavelengths out there, and shorter and shorter. And then there's a whole bunch of longer and longer and longer wavelengths. And so the world is, and we've explored the world with those. So things that break down in one region, because as you push the envelope further and further away from our ordinary everyday life, you discover things that were not known earlier. But it doesn't mean, within the framework that Newton worked, he is absolutely okay. You can't give him enough credit. Somebody else had a question.
What would you say was Einstein's most important contribution to the history of thought?
Did you hear that question? What would I say is Einstein's most important contribution to the history of thought? Holy mackerel. I'm going to answer that, and I will suggest and I would predict that if you ask me that same question tomorrow, I'll probably answer differently. That's a hard question, you know. But I'll say one thing that I think is probably important, and that is that because of the theory of relativity, we've really come to recognize that what we once thought was really reliable, our common sense, has to be looked at carefully. And we can't just conclude that common sense ideas are valid. Our concept of space and time is valid only because we move at such a small pace. But significantly, E equals mc squared shows itself in a nuclear bomb, and it shows itself in nuclear power plants, and it shows itself as you're sitting there, you're losing mass. Why? Because you're radiating energy. You have a temperature of 90, whatever it is. Oh, that's Fahrenheit. You see, America is crazy. Anyways, you have a temperature that is above the temperature of this room. And so you're radiating energy into this room. And as you radiate energy, that energy is, you're losing mass. And in every way, in many ways, all day, every day, Einstein's ideas are having effect. So come back to the question. I think it was very hard to be told that we were that our concepts of time, that simultaneity, which you talked about so nicely, as a very common broad theme from 18, I forget where, to 1910, 15, something like that period of time, a theme. And I would say, I think that maybe, I don't know, that the interest in that theme was probably enhanced by Einstein's work at some point from the latter part. But anyways, you know, we think we know. When two events happen, we think they're simultaneous for us and they're simultaneous for everybody. Well, that's not true. If two lightning bolts hit your head, see, you shouldn't sit in the front row. If two lightning bolts hit your head, everybody in the universe at the same time, hit the head, everybody in the universe says they're simultaneous. Everybody. Two events occurring at the same point in space, her head. Everybody agrees they're simultaneous. But if a lightning bolt hits your head, and a lightning bolt hits your head, and I stand here and say, oh, those were simultaneous, then inertial observers in different inertial reference frames, they will all disagree. No, no, no. The one hit her first and then her second. And somebody else says, no, 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 no. Her first and her second. So when events occur at different points in space or on the ground or, you know, in space, then simultaneity is dependent upon who is observing the two events. Well, that's kind of weird, you know. I don't know. Your question is a good question, and I say I'll answer it differently tomorrow.
And at this point, I do think we should wrap up. I would like to give a very, very special warm round of applause to Professor Reagan, not only
Listen. I would like to applaud you. You have been a great group. Perimeter Institute, I don't know if you guys live in this town. You live in Canada, I guess. I don't know. But A, you should be very pleased that Perimeter Institute is here, that Perimeter Institute is doing this sort of thing. They have been wonderful to me. And I never dreamed, I did not think, there would be an audience that would want to come out and hear. But look at you. I mean, I have wondered more than once. I've wondered 3 or 4 times, could this happen in the United States?
When you exit, please exit by the stairs up above. I also want to remind you that there will be, if John is sufficiently well-rested, in another 45 minutes, there will be a bistro banter session with myself and Stephen Kern and John up in the bistro. It's just an informal discussion Q&A. I hope to see at least some of you there, and hope to see you all back here at Einstein Fest during the festival. Thank you very much.